The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI-FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
Allen Ginsberg at Naropa.
We had our own primitive Buddhism of a kind. A lot through Cassidy, because he was a very speedy person, mm-hmm. but his particular speed was speed of mind recollection. And he used to talk about, now we are having this conversation, but this conversation is going on 7 levels at once. Now the first level is just the conversation about the car driving back and forth between Luann's house and your house where we're going to make love. But then the second level, remember, was that we were thinking about when we were going to get up to go out to work, because we all had to work. And the third level was the fact that we were all here in Denver for the first time together, and Jack was expected any day. And the fourth level was the fact that none of us have any money, so we have to think about that too while we're in bed making love. And the fifth level was that we have a lot of friends from Denver to see, and that was all referred to in the conversation 4 sentences back. If you remember, if you hearken back to what we were saying 4 sentences back, so he would sometimes babble on, actually retrospecting the entire mind consciousness involved in our conversations, and then pointing out also the moments of 6th level of nobody had anything to say, and there was like a big gap in between the words, and everybody was saying, mm-hmm. And the 7th level that we were all here together in the same place. Mm-hmm. So, just making it up, but I did do remember back in 48 him talking about sort of naive, introspective system that he spontaneously came up with one day of recalling that there were 6 or 7 levels of awareness or association in any split-second thought. And so there was already a search for the basis of the mind, and a search into the mind, and that was the basis of Kerouac's spontaneous prose to exploit and explore present consciousness during the time of writing. And it was really a lot of the basis even of Neil's interest in car driving. Mm-hmm. The princely power to drive a car, pay attention to everything that was going on the road, pay attention to everything that had to be done in the car, pay attention to who needed a cigarette in the car, simultaneously carrying on a conversation with someone in the back who was worried about getting home in time, and simultaneously feeling up his girlfriend.
And going 110 miles an hour.
Who had her dress up to her knees in the front seat, and simultaneously keeping his eye out for a gas station where he could steal some gas. So there was always this preoccupation with a present moment, immediacy, nowness, with a kind of mellow foreknowledge of the fact that it was all to be extincted and doomed and wiped out in the blink of an eye, that there was an element of illusion finally, there was a possibility of some moment when everything was going on at once and all elements of thought and speech and perception and music on the radio were apprehended at once, and the whole thing would be in one cosmic swinging symphonic jazz chorus.
So where did you take it from there?
India.
Right away?
Death in India. Well, I mean, people died and mm-hmm. I went to India.
When did you first go to India?
62.
Uh-huh.
We took it to there, from there to Beat Generation, which is to say collapse of formal mind in America and an opening up of informal mind, actual mind, which mm-hmm. is what that meant, that phrase, among other things, with the implication of beatific somewhere, as Kerouac always pointed out.
You're listening to Allen Ginsberg discussing the influence of Buddhism on his work, in an interview with Duncan Campbell. This discussion was taped at Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, where Ginsberg gives seminars on poetry during the summer. In the course of his talk, Allen Ginsberg relates the influence of Buddhism to the origins of the beatific or beat writers, such as himself, Neil Cassady, Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder, and William Burroughs. For Allen Ginsberg, the Buddhist mantras are at the root of oral poetry and have given rise to the current movement of singing and chanting in the performance of poetry.
How did you first get into Buddhism, for instance? So was it Kerouac that first began to pick up on those texts?
No, it was Cassady that began studying Edgar Cayce in the early 50s, 48, 49, 50, as a result of smoking lots and lots and lots of grass and splitting his mind up into a million fragments and having recall of previous lifetimes. And he ran into Cayce's works and systems, which were sort of, which Kerouac was disgusted at, because it was like, he wrote me a letter saying, Neil is spouting endlessly about this guy, Edgar Cayce, like Billy Sunday in a suit or something. All of a sudden, instead of being a railroad conductor, he's talking about reincarnation in six lifetimes before and the simultaneous perception of seven lifetimes, just like he was talking about seven levels of thought. And so Jack went to the San Jose Public Library to look up Dwight Goddard's Buddhist Bible, to check back on the original sources of theories of reincarnation, particularly that Neil was transmuting and transmitting through Cayce and through his own sort of funny Proustian total recall mind. Proust was part of that too, incidentally, because Cassady was very good at reading Proust aloud. Because in a single sentence of Proust, there might be a beginning with Baron Charlus's oily, curled French 1910 hairstyle and settling in on the gleam of a lock of hair, Proust would go through history and bring the sentence back to the Hanging Gardens of Babylon as the image of his hair. Mm-hmm. So Neil appreciated Proust's high style as Eliot appreciated Milton's high style as being able to include a jump in mind from heaven all the way to the bottom of hell and in between in one long syntactically coherent phrasing.
Did Neil himself ever then get into Buddhism in any way?
Oh, in and out, but the Buddhism that Jack first discovered was somewhat Hinayana Catholic.
Yeah,
so there was still a god, sort of.
What tradition was that?
Well, that is worshipping a Buddha, rather than an atheistical version. And lots of rules, and don't eat cheese or something.
But was it Theravadan, or what sources was he working with at that
Well, time? Whatever there was in the Buddhist Bible, I don't know what texts there were, but I think there were texts on don't eat until afternoon, and don't let your thought wander, and follow your breath, or examine the mind itself, see the skandhas and the conceptions of impermanence, and the noble truths, and there was regulatory Buddhism,
Buddhism. When did the image of Bodhisattva begin to emerge?
Kerouac knew it, but I think that took more place in our thought when we ran into Gary Snyder in 55, which is just 3 years later, in San Francisco. And Gary was also Buddhist, but a practicing meditative Mahayanist, studying Zen
tradition.
Yeah, and he'd already studied Chinese and Japanese languages and was finishing off his study of the languages at Berkeley and preparing to go to Japan to study in Daitokuji, under the auspices of the First Zen Institute of America, a scholarship which he had from Ruth Sasaki, who had been married to Roshi Sasaki, who had originally come to America in 1898 for the World Parliament of Religions with two other Zen masters, accompanied by a secretary, D.T. Suzuki, who spoke English well. So there was with Gary, there was this connection with the ancient, with the lineage, with the tradition, and with the actual formal framework of Buddhism, whereas ours was all sort of intuitive night ride hallucinations and the realization that dawn that everything we were was unsubstantial.
Well, I remember that one line in Earth Household. He has, I think Gary Snyder has that line of, there comes a time when the poet must choose either to go all the way out with the possibility of some sort of beautiful transcendence or dying wormishly like a dog, or steeping himself deeply in the tradition of his own country or his own writing or whatever. It seemed that that was sort of nicely put. What do you think about that?
I don't know.
Do you really think there is that kind of black and white sort of choice?
No, I'm not a triplicist or a dualist. Though I think what Gary's done has been remarkable. He's chosen to steep himself in the woods, in the American Indian tradition, and sort of unify that in Buddhism, because the old Buddhism was woodsy Buddhism, after all, with mountain hermits and people chopping their own firewood and wearing animal skins and meditating in caves and communing with nature on a mountain. Or just sort of clearing the space to sit by going to a mountain where the vibes of the city were less aggressive. But we didn't get to the Mahayana Bodhisattva idea until, or I didn't know, hear about that until Gary's presence. And I was amazed to find another Buddhist. And so I thought, Kerouac's coming to town, they better meet, because Gary sits and he's a practicing Buddhist, and Jack's been on Buddhism, and I've been resisting it and resenting it all along. Or had been somewhat. Just the idea of nothing coming from nothing, and nothing is nothing, which was Jack's reduction of it all. Nothing's nothing. Nothing comes from nothing, and that's that. So don't, you know, excite your vanity by thinking you're going to make something.
Was this about the time that Jack had written that poem about the rose garden, where he was sniffing the roses and he had a kind of white-out vision?
Yeah, I think that had occurred before.
Uh-huh.
He'd already written that. And,
but it was that was, in a sense, what you're talking about, the nothing from nothing kind of visionary thing.
No, for that, but for him it was more, he had sat and watched his father die. Just like Buddha had gone out on the road and seen an old beggar dying on the road. Jack had an example of death in front of him, of like the shrinking of the mortal rose, and the complete eradication, abolishment of any notion of vanity or person or self, as he saw his father belly filled with water and have to empty it every night and grumble and complain and then die sort of starkly on his bed with a bony nose and life depart and the whole dream over. So Jack got a signal that the dream was over already. So actually his phrasing at the time was, life is a dream already ended. It's very beautiful, actually, and it's quite true, I think, of Buddhist poetics. Life is a dream already ended. So he was saying that it all ends up in the golden ash. All our Empire State Buildings end in golden ash. Gary introduced a much more formal framework that he got from Mahayana and Bodhisattva, that he got from his studies of language and his actual practice and his reading of Suzuki and contact with some actual Zen practitioners.
And also, I think, had he not been reading the Chinese Zen poems of Han Shan?
Yeah, he's already translating those. He was in the middle of translating them. So Jack's Buddhism was directly from the experience of pain, the first noble truth of existence, beginning with his father's death, most, I think. So we already had that. It was a very early awareness of the fact that we were all mortal, and mortal poopy dolls wandering on the stage trying to patch together our vanities to make an existence when it was all going to be wiped out. And so he saw sort of like the... It's a primitive tragedy of the scene. And by 1951, he was saying that the center of America is a lonely back alley behind the stores and movie houses where the red bricks at midnight in the moonlight are totally solitary with no observer. Which is not dissimilar to Chogyam's photographs of totally unobserved corners of the room or flowers like in a solitude without an eye.
What was it about Buddhism that began to pick up the interest of more and more poets at that point?
Two things. First, the concept of Satori, because all of us had some form or other of a lightning mind or visionary apprehension or religious experience of a sudden kind, like Kerouac describes in the Scripture of the Golden Eternity, and as I've described in... I think some interviews, a meeting with Blake's presence, or a meeting with the Ancient of Days, so to speak, in which Snyder experienced in 1948, same time as us, more or less, alone by the banks of the Willamette River after finishing a big, long intellectual history of Western Gnosticism or anthropological cynicism or something. I don't know what he was writing about, but something to do with American Indians and peyote and knowledge and epistemology and Western history and ecology, which he was already interested in. So he'd finished that about 4 in the morning and gone down to the darkness, Portland, to the banks of the Willamette River, is it?
I'm not sure.
And went down gully with a lot of trees, and it was total dead silence, pre-dawn. Sat there, in while he was sort of in a sort of brown study, observing the deadness of all creation around him, or the complete inanimacy of creation around him, the complete movelessness. Suddenly, thousands of birds, as the sun creaked over Riverside Hill, birds rose up out of all of the branches of the trees. It was a great noisy flock rising at dawn, and he suddenly realized everything's alive. Mm-hmm. The entire universe is alive. So he had some special Satori of a kind. Actually, I read about the word Satori in Suzuki in the New York Public Library, and that seemed to be the right fit and word for what I had actually experienced. So then I got interested in Buddhism, though I didn't see the connections, and I didn't see the more sophisticated later considerations that Satori was irrelevant. Actually, and the vision was irrelevant, and you shouldn't cling to it, and mm-hmm. all that stuff. So we'd all had some experience of I think at the time the phrasing that I used was a break in the continuity of normal consciousness and a new mode of consciousness apparent. That coinciding with a complete break in the continuity of normal consciousness in America post-war and the beginning of the sort of violent apocalyptic ecological rundown and degeneration of social conscience here, and the increasing sort of Nazification and robotization of thought with television permeating everywhere. So, and for Burroughs, of course, was always into sort of like a Faustian exploration of his mind, beginning with, let's say, as a sort of searcher of souls and cities, mm-hmm. A searcher of the void as an exterminator in Chicago, and playing around with drugs for seeing different modalities of consciousness, interest in Reich, interested in a system of progressive relaxation that was still practiced after the instructions of a doctor named Jacobson, I think was his the title of his book, Progressive Relaxation. So that was a sort of meditation exercise. Relax your arm, your skull, your eyes, all the way down to your toes, in corpse posture. Burroughs was also interested in the difference between language and apprehension through Korshevsky's Science and Sanity, which I noticed the other day in the Karmazong Library. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was one of the first books he handed me to read, simply pointing out the difference between words and the things they represent. So like the first, from Burroughs's understanding, well, we had a koan. A friend of mine and I got into a big discussion of, if you carved a beautiful walking stick on the moon and left it there, nobody ever saw it, is it art or not? No, is art communicative or not? So if a walking stick is on the moon, is it art or is it not? And so we couldn't figure it out, so we finally brought it to Burroughs. He said, I never heard of such a ridiculous argument of walking stick on the moon. Like, you've created this verbal construction, and then are trying to find out how you want to call it. I mean, if you call it art, it's art. If you don't call it art, it isn't art. It's only a word. You got yourself confused with words, which is very similar to the Zen koan of you got a full-grown goose in the bottle, and how do you get the goose out of the bottle without breaking the bottle or wounding or injuring the goose? You know that koan?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, the answer, you know?
I don't remember the answer. I've got one.
Burroughs gave the answer. It's out.
That's what I mean. That's what I just on
same
my
way
mind,
you put
yeah.
it in, it's out. You put it in with words, you can take mm-hmm. it out with mm-hmm. gesture or words, too. So we already had a sort of funny personal practice. Burroughs also had been psychoanalyzed at great length by Dr. Louis Federn, who was one of Freud's descendants and who had been analyzed by Freud. And in those years, Burroughs analyzed me for about a year, and Jack. He was then going by then to Dr. Louis Wahlberg, who was practicing hypnoanalysis. So there's a lot of messing around with levels of consciousness and levels of character and character between character and how we all contain many, many characters. And we even play charades of, I think I was a well-groomed Hungarian, and Burroughs was the louche, bull-dyke lesbian baroness from Hungary. And those later sort of worked themselves up into funny routines, with Jack being like a kid with a straw hat at the circus, being led around into trouble by the well-groomed Hungarian who takes him to the baroness.
The baroness,
wants to f*** him or something. Or get his money, marry him for his take his money. And all those finally became routines, similar to the first routines of, in Naked Lunch. So Naked Lunch grew out of that play between us.
Oh, God.
So we were also very actively, we had in 1946 and 7, I had the phrase supreme reality as my goal. We were all looking for supreme reality with capital S and capital M. I used to write poems about supreme reality. Till I had this breakthrough vision in which which shattered all my language. So anyway, this is all preliminary, by 51, Kerouac had formulated his Buddhist notions and had written a big book of several years' study called Sum of the Dharma, consisting in haikus and comments on Surangama Sutra, Diamond Sutra, Lankavatara Sutra, on Hinayana texts and practices, on some Tibetan Buddhist practices. Because I remember he's got a little phrase in one of his poems, Dhamema, Mother of Buddhas.
Mm-hmm.
And I never knew who Dhamema was, and so I started reading the life of Marpa,
mm-hmm.
and realized it was Marpa's wife. And that's why it was Dhamema, Mother of Buddhas. So Jack knew all that, or goes into it some way or other, and knew all Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, or knew all that terminology, and had some idea of gradations of realization, and also an idea that it didn't make any difference. So, but when we met Snyder in 55, with the upsurge of San Francisco poetizing, then it was all sort of codified more. And then we had the advantage of like being able to draw on Snyder's really elegant sort of library and resources. And then Whalen came to town, and Whalen was just as learned as Snyder in Buddhist texts. And so, 56, we were hanging around in a shack in Mill Valley, the time of Dharma Bums,
mm-hmm.
era for Kerouac and Snyder. You know, discussing Suzuki's translation of Lankavatara Sutra and comparing notes on it. Just doing it by ourselves without any connection except maybe Snyder to any formal study.
Mm-hmm. Or to a teacher, for that matter.
Or to a teacher. Uh-huh. There were no teachers then, hardly. I don't know if mm-hmm. it was a... I don't know if maybe Suzuki had come to... Roshi Suzuki had perhaps mm-hmm. come to America by then, but I'm not sure.
I think it was in the late 50s or the early 60s, maybe 60, 61 at the earliest, I think.
Yeah. So this was back in 55. Of course, there was some Gnostic tradition to go with through Kenneth Rexroth and the anarchist poetry circle in San Francisco. The surrealist tradition of Gnosticism that Philip Lamentin knew a lot about, having lived with Britton and other people in New York. And Rexroth, I think, had already written prefaces to fragments of Forgotten Faith, was it?
Okay.
Gnostic fragment, like a great classic, a compilation of Gnostic documents. And he knew all about that. And William Everson, Brother Antoninus, had already read and written a great deal about early church theosophical notions. And there was a theosophical inheritance here. Gavin Arthur had been a friend of Meher Baba in the 20s. Gavin Arthur of San Francisco, an astrologer, grandson of President Chester Arthur, and formerly a newsboy on Sutter and Market, had, where was he, newsboy? Where the cable car comes down into Market. Gavin Arthur was a sort of like a circle of elders around San Francisco. Watts was running the Asian Institute. Gary and I were going there occasionally. That's in the 50s. But Arthur, to get back to Arthur, like he had known Edward Carpenter, who had known Walt Whitman, and so there was some kind of transmission there. And Sam Lewis was around.
Mm-hmm. Sufi Sam Lewis, yeah.
With Gavin, and so I saw a lot of Sam then, and got to be one of his first disciples in a way. We had a big exchange of correspondence, and he asked me if he could be my guru, and I said yes, certainly. And we never did anything except he taught me la ilaha illallah, which I started chanting.
So was that your first guru, in a sense, in any kind of spiritual way?
No, that was later, because I'd been to India already.
Uh-huh.
I was already chanting. It was already 60s. But there was that atmosphere back in San Francisco, around Gavin Arthur particularly, who was a great friend of Neil Cassidy. Slept with him all the time. Or whenever Neil had nowhere to go, he wound up in Gavin's house, sort of falling asleep exhausted in his bed. But there was very little, at that time, very little influence of Judaism or Hasidism or Buber. till 1960. Went to, on the way to India with Peter Orlovsky, we went to see Buber and talk with him about LSD. But that's much later. Mm-hmm. That's already, the whole beat movement was already textualized and formulated and famous, and we were getting out from under and going to India. And, mm-hmm. I resisted and resented the notion of nothingness, or the, what I thought to be the negativity of Kerouac's Buddhism. There may have been a somewhat anti-life element in it, as mm-hmm. he'd drink himself to death, like total fear of samsara. Like, he didn't want to leave his mother, he didn't want to throw her to the dogs of eternity, like I did mine, he accused me. So he had this sort of a horrific, tragic vision of the first noble truth. And though there may have been a third noble truth, that ignorance has an end, suffering has an end, I think he saw samsara on earth as endless and unbreakable. In terms of a novelist, seeing people go through their crowny, rosy careers and then crash on thorns and die, and mm-hmm. get ripped up in auto crashes. Also, we had an experience of sudden death with a friend of ours in 46 around Columbia. And experiences of jail very early, people, friends going to jail, and the experience of this, what Rex Roth calls the social lie, that is the, what's totally visible now, say with Nixon's tape things, the difference between public language as it's presented to the public and private thought and language as it's really spoken. And out of that came the study of language and private language and spoken language and street language and Oki language and correlating with work by William Carlos Williams, who was in another way doing exactly the same thing, just trying to live in the present, write about his own Rutherford speech, write in his own Rutherford speech forms, and use his own tongue and use his own mind and not let his mind wander, but have a sort of single-mindedness or one-pointedness in relation to locale and place where he was, which fitted in a funny way. So it was like a real sort of rediscovery of America as in on the road, of the actual body of America, as distinct from the patriotic songs and the war glamour echoes. And that's why Cassidy was so important to us, because he was from sort of Denver, which seemed to be like the far west, mm-hmm. as if we were Europeans. He was like the western cowboy. The radiant, glorious cowboy with Okie talk and reformatories and cattle and cars and reformatory sentimentalities and high school teacher friends from Denver. And so it seemed like mid-American heartland speaking. And he'd gone when he was a kid to get out of the cold to the library and read all through Kant and was really interested in epistemology at the time. But his big change was when we all met, he decided that poetry was more important than philosophy, because it was an enactment of philosophy. You know, it was an active mm-hmm. manifestation rather than just thought forms. So I guess we made our religion poetry, or we practiced our religion as poetry and saw poetry as the sentimental and also practical and also prophetic, priestly. Life that we wanted to carry on in America.
So poetry,
save America.
Poetry, in a sense, was the practice. Poetry, I mean, the link practice. Between the idea and the daily life.
It still is for me. It's the practice of reflection, the practice of recall what we were thinking, seven levels of thought, and what was in between them. So there are a lot of parallels between Buddhism as practiced now and poetics as practiced then. And that's really why it was so potent, why the poetry was so potent at that time, because it really was sort of an examination of what actual present mind was as distinct from what it was supposed to be in the schools or in politics.
What kind of transformations took place in the 60s? It seems like for a variety of reasons, some of them political, like sharing that experience of the social lie through the mm-hmm. disappointment of radical movements and drug experiences and so on, that maybe a wide variety of people began to turn on to that same kind of rhythm of insight that you took about in the 50s.
Well, I think one reason that people shared it, because we were so coherent in our articulation of it poetically, and we had to change the forms of poetry and prose, which is like a solid thing to do, like building a building or something. And so there was a tremendous amount of energy released when we broke the forms open in language. Because after all, everything is run by language. You know, all the machines and all the people and all the politics, it's all language anyway, it's all the word. Till Burroughs finally in the 60s arrived at the phrase, rub out the word, which is the same as, I think, equivalent to shunyata for in his practice.
Mm-hmm.
But then the whole ecological degeneration and oversimplification and plasticization of America had begun, and the American dream was no longer so viable as it was for Wolfe or for Melville or Whitman or Thoreau. And we were using Whitman, Thoreau, Melville as models too.
Now, I remember Kerouac predicting at one point then, about that time, a rucksack revolution that was going to take place, which seems to be somewhat in that same line, kind of a rediscovery
of the body,
America.
Of the body of America, the actual land,
mm-hmm.
Rather than the floating city consciousness, the dissociated, floating, unconnected, bodiless city consciousness. So there was, in a way, a return to physiology, or what Olson later would call, like, seeing poetry as an extension of physiology. The breath, the actual breath, and the actual thought.
That movement seems to be shared in the theater too. In the last few years,
it well, it's sort of universal.
Kind of a universal thing that's happening in the arts.
I think we were sort of like a foam on the crest of a huge wave of transformation of world consciousness, or of civilized consciousness, industrial consciousness, and a recognition that, as in McLuhan, that some link to actual Earth had been broken. And that you had to get, to have any stability, you had to get back to the Buddha nature, in that sense, Buddha family, brown earth. Kerouac's phrase was, the earth is an Indian thing, in On the Road. The earth is an Indian thing. And he was really pleased with that little lyric.
Mm-hmm.
The future's in Fellaheen. I don't mean to sound as if we knew what we were doing, because we didn't. It was just operating on our own natures and pure intuition and trusting our own natures,
uh-huh.
Figuring that exposition of self-nature would be the best, wisest, safest, honestest, clearest, solidest way, rather than sort of diddling around with theories of existentialism or theories of knowledge or theories of poetics that were being taught in the schools or theories of politics that were being pronounced over the radio by Truman when he took over from Roosevelt.
Was there any influence at all of existentialism?
None.
None at all.
None of us read any of the books.
Uh-huh.
They were parallel thoughts, but I thought existentialism, and still do, was an intellectual practice, mm-hmm. rather than a physical practice.
Mm-hmm.
It was a theory of being spontaneous and a theory of confronting the void, but they weren't out there doing it. And mm-hmm. then when they went out there to do it, it was in purely political terms, which involved a tremendous amount of aggression
mm-hmm.
and hatred. And Kerouac's main proposition was the lamminess of non-existence, the lamminess of illusion. Like the down in the valley of the lambs, up on the peak top bats. Up on the peak top of the mind, bats, down in the valley of the lambs. Down in the valley of the body, I guess. But high on the peak top bats, down in the valley of the lambs. So Kerouac got increasingly offended by the hippie outgrowth of beatnikism, where it got into aggressive politics.
In the 60s?
Yeah, and uh-huh. thought it, and withdrew completely from that. Because he thought it was that me and Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and others were discovering new reasons for spitefulness. Merely discovering new reasons for spitefulness. And he hated that conception of kill your parents and the lack of basic family traditional dignity involved. It's not an Indian thing. It's not an Indian notion. It's not a Fellaheen notion.
Well, what effect did that have on you at that time? I mean,
I figured that from a bodhisattva point of view, one had to manifest some kind of intelligence in the world, some kind of cosmic intelligence in worldly form. And so my practice was to go around to Chicago by 68 chanting Om and trying to calm the scene. But I felt some step forward into the world was necessary, into the political world. And then I was sort of a little bit attracted by the aggression, and was probably too aggressive, but you know, enraptured by it like everybody else. But I had a very solid foundation in Blake, and in vision and in realization that the whole thing was a... Actually, in 61, I sort of wrote a long thing about the Cuban Revolution, saying that the trouble with it is that they didn't take into account the fact that the world may not exist. And that was absolutely necessary for a complete political, social revolution. Like a so we were talking about a revolution of consciousness in, I think, back as far as 57, we're talking about new consciousness, with capital N, capital C, in some interviews in an old City Lights journal, and a lot of essays I wrote. And back in 58, I was concerned with the growth of the military as being kind of a Moloch robot that was going to take over everybody's consciousness, and measuring it by the budget of $30 billion that year. 30 out of the $70 billion was military, 30 out of the $80 billion budget was military. As it's $100 billion to $300 billion now. $100 billion military, $300 billion budget.
Mm-hmm.
Kerouac thought that that was just a lot of Dostoevsky and Snitkin intellectual worry. the main thing was the heart and the lamb and St. Matthew's Passion and the fact that we were all going to die. Burroughs, meanwhile, was working all independently on something much more tantric, I think. Actually experimenting on his body with rubbing out the word and looking at the stroboscopes and taking drugs and practicing cut-ups of his own writing to cut out of his own obsessional imagery and inventing a sort of homemade tantra for Yankee tantra.
Because his Yankee tantra,
because his grandfather invented the adding machine or invented some little sprocket in the adding machine that made it work. So he had the same Yankee ingenuity and he was applying that to his own consciousness. And so getting into Reich and into the Dianetics and into Scientology and all sorts of things that he went through, like from progressive relaxation and psychoanalysis, looking through everything. This is like a Faustian explorer, which was Kerouac's version of Burroughs as the last of the Faustian men.
Mm-hmm. Well, when did you yourself first encounter Tibetan Buddhism? Or the notion of Tantra in
back
addition to
in
Mahayana?
That never got really clear until recently. Except the notion of like freewheeling, freestyle, open form, spontaneity, to the extent that that's tantric, and observation of the absurd gap consciousness. But I didn't have that word then. Well, Kerouac had an idea of it, like the invalid is glad to listen to the scratch between announcements on the radio, and
mm-hmm.
gleefully seeing the storm dots on the television screen instead of the picture. And seeing that in his own mind. That's 53. The scratch between announcements on the radio. Listening to the scratch between announcements. So listening to the background, the field, the background field, the Dharmakaya area. I had come into contact with Zen through painting, through going to the museum, the New York Library, and looking at Southern Song Zen painting. Sakyamuni coming out of the mountain by Lan Kai, which is, I don't know, 12th century or so. I'd written a poem about that in 53. But that was sparked by Kerouac's interest. Actually, tantric practices of a kind we were imitating funny, homemade, goofy, silly, untutored in Dharma bums with sort of a banquet orgies.
The yab yum and so on.
Yeah. Which was not very far off the mark, actually. And it was pretty unselfconscious and sort of spontaneous practice. And, fun. And we were learning a lot. But also getting very close, you know, to each other. And there was also that some element of sexual revolution there and a recognition of the complete variable nature of identity, and not bisexuality, but that we were worms and lizards as well as humans, men's and women's, that we were clouds. Gary got into Tantra probably late 50s with the in Japan through Mahayana Buddhism, and then he branched off and was interested in the Yamabushi sect, which I think is supposed to be sort of tantric. took some initiations with them. That's the sort of Japanese tantra.
Mm-hmm.
Mountain walking, people with fires on the mountains. And Burroughs was practicing a sort of homemade tantra without the name. Tibetan Book of the Dead came up 1944, recommended by Raymond Weaver to Kerouac. And I don't think we actually got into it or looked at it till the early 50s. And it got more and more, I got more and more involved in it in the late 50s when I was taking peyote and used to use that with peyote. And then by 1960, went to South America and brought back some ayahuasca and took a lot of trips using the Tibetan Book of the Dead as a sort of a suggestion book while I was getting high. But with no notion of how to practice or whether it was accurate or anything like that, simply that it presented a gorgeous universe full of possibility that did seem to relate to the visions I had with Blake and also related to Blake and at the same time related to the horrific visions that I'd had in visions of Moloch, say, on acid or on peyote. And I used it in 59 at Stanford. I had a copy around when I took my first LSD, arranged by Gregory Bateson at the Stanford Medical School.
Was that the same period Kesey was taking it, in 59 or 60?
No, Kesey
was that later?
Until the 60s, that was much later. So we'd begun with peyote in 51. Peyote first arrived in the Lower East Side in 50. And I first turned on in 51, and Kerouac and Neil and Philip Lamantia first turned on to peyote probably 1950, up in Big Sur in Jaime de Angulo's stone house.
Mm-hmm.
De Angulo having been an old Gnostic anthropologist, hero of Gary Snyder, who wrote very beautiful poems and was one of the first linguists to analyze American Indian language from the point of view of how did they think, you know, sort of metalinguistics, like what was their thought conscious process as indicated by their vocabulary and syntax and stories. So a peyote in that area was around then, and in 53 Kerouac wrote a really beautiful account of a peyote experience, saying, "Neil, it's the death of the heart," which is quite true in a way. In a way, the death of the human and the beginning of like another panoramic consciousness. In the Visions of Cody, there's a very beautiful account of that first peyote experience.
Well, where has all this brought you now in the 70s?
Well, we've gone through, we really skipped the 60s in a way, like all that activity. Burroughs continued his studies and detoxified and got clear of that and arrived wherever place he is now through mid-60s, so got stabilized there. I had been to India in 62 and 63 with Snyder,
mm-hmm.
who was coming fresh from his monastery and so quite an adept already and knew where to go and knew to go to Bodh Gaya and things like that. We went to visit the Dalai Lama and he knew how to get down on the floor and bow properly. We went to see Anagarika Govinda because by this time we'd known the Book of the Dead and things like that, and Gary had read some of his work. I went to see Dujun Rinpoche just maybe a half year after seeing Martin Buber.
Mm-hmm.
For the same reason, to question him about some of the horrific visions I'd had on acid.
What did he say?
If you see anything horrible, don't cling to it. If you see anything beautiful, don't cling to it. Which was like a phrase that was like a sword, Manjushri sword, cut right through my confusion then and just solved the whole problem. And I asked for Wong then, not knowing what it was and not knowing what preparation was necessary. And I wasn't in the habit of sitting either by then, but I'd done a little. I went to see Karmapa Lama then also, and probably spent an afternoon with Rinpoche in the Lama's home school that he was the preceptor or advisor
mm-hmm.
at, through Freda Beatty, now Sister Pomo,
mm-hmm.
whom I met then, and Peter worked for, Orlovsky worked for a while, with the Lama's home school. We went on a trip to the Lama's home school and visited around. And also went to see all the holy men I could find everywhere, Hindu, and went to Shivananda, who said your own heart is your guru. He's a teacher of Satchinananda. So we went to see a lot of people, or I went to see a lot of people, and we all did together and went to all the holy places and took a regular pilgrimage. Looking for a guru, I was. Except that everybody said, don't stop looking for a guru. If you're ripe, it'll come to you,
mm-hmm.
you don't need it. So I really did sort of stop looking and checked out every holy man I could find in any city I was.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, heard Hare Krishna and began singing that too. So I began discovering mantra. Discovered mantra actually in the cave of Ajanta with Gary Snyder. When we got into this cave and he sat down and chanted in Japanese the Prajnaparamita Sutra, which I'd never heard before, fully sung in Japanese in a ritual manner. You know, kanji zai bo satsu gyo jin hanya haramita jisho kengo unkai kudo isai ku. So he was doing that like full voice in this cave, echoing. It maybe hadn't been chanted in there for 1,000 years or something. So began hearing sound and heard a little about Shabda Yoga and got sort of intrigued by that as poet. And then attended a mushaira at the Taj Mahal, Christmas 62, which was the first occasion of totally spontaneous improvised poetry I'd seen outside of Kerouac, and that, and the thing we used to do under the Brooklyn Bridge, just making up lines in the moonlight. So when I came back to America, I went to a poetry conference, and the first thing I started doing was chanting Hare Krishna as a sort of social party thing to get everybody together, 63 August. And then I also spent some time in Japan with Gary on the way back and went and did a session at his monastery. So that was the first sitting I did regularly. I'd done a little pranayama yoga before. 4, 8, 16, count of breath. 5 minutes a day for about a year. And a little sitting. I spent a lot of time in the burning grounds observing the corpses, which is a traditional practice. Mm-hmm. Smoking ganja in the burning grounds. But like in Japan was sort of like cooled out, you know, very formal sitting. And also, you know, a lot of theory, a lot of intellectual awareness, a lot of text. Gary was then working, translating the book that's now known as Zen Dust, the translation of all the koans, an orderly translation of all the koans put out by the Zen Institute. Burton Watson was translating Tsutung Po in Kyoto, and so Gary and I worked with him trying to Americanize the phrasing of his translations and get it really hip, like modern poetry.
That raises an interesting question in itself. Do you think it's possible to create ultimately an indigenous American Buddhism?
Well, we were practicing some form of unlettered and indigenous American Buddhism all along, actually, I think. Mm-hmm. Even before Jack discovered Buddhism. It just didn't have any names or order or teachers or depth of, you know, total depth. And I think we were, I mean, we knew we were going to die anyway, that much. And we were interested in that rather than scared of it. And we were interested in consciousness, as the whole nation was, finally. I mean, in other words, yeah, I think, because remember, Buddhism isn't Buddhism either. Buddhism is nature, the nature of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some transmission of approaches to it. But even the sense of transmission was something that in poetry is an old tradition too, from poet to poet. Transmission of voice. Like, I didn't understand Williams till I heard him speak and went to see him and got the word from him, in the sense that keep to active language and clamp the mind down on objects and pay attention to minute particulars. And that's like runs through Wordsworth, Blake, Williams, Pound. The Buddhist transmission, the Tibetan style, of course there was all that imagery before a Book of the Dead, and that was so gorgeous, and the mandala, which was so much like our own experience, on and off acid, or peyote. But there had never been anybody to teach the actual practices and actual meditation before, except like Suzuki and Zen. But there hadn't been that open form, that, you know, or say the idea of experiment. I see Tantra as experiment on the body, really. Experimental, practical, granny wisdom. There's a hint of that in the American Indians already, and a lot of that in poetry already. But nobody had been able to teach the doctrines we were dreaming about, like, or I was dreaming about, like Book of the Dead. But the crucial moment was, for me, in meeting Rinpoche, was when I had a conversation with him about his lecture tours, and I asked him, wasn't he bored going around over and over the same? He said, no, it's because I always speak from my mind then. And I said, I'm bored a little with my poetry readings. He said, that's because you don't like your poetry.
Hmm.
And I was at my peak as a poet, so it was a really interesting suggestion, which I resented not too much. I said, what do you mean? And he said, why don't you do like the real great, like great poets, the ancient poets, like Milarepa? Why do you need a piece of paper for your poetry? Why can't you get up and improvise on the stage, or improvise your poetry? Which I'd been doing all along on page, and which had been Kerouac's prescription and insistency on no revision, but, you know, speak now or ever hold your peace, with total consciousness, total mind, everything at once, total confession. So that we'd got mind to Shapley, art to Shapley, and then I tried that night at one of his meetings, very, very awkwardly. But then the next night I had to do a benefit for Tarthang Tulku, and it was the first time I ever got on stage without a text, and had to improvise it out of whole cloth, out of what I was thinking at the moment. And it was a little awkward and unfinished, but it was so profound. I just got into a song about how does it feel, isn't it beautiful to be an American, and then went through a list of all the samsara here, using my harmonium with a two-chord form. And it was so liberating. I mean, I realized I didn't have to worry about if I lost my poems anymore, because I was the poet. I could just make it up. And so I began practicing that more and more at every reading and getting into it. So I do it all the time now at readings, at some point or other. And even have given a few readings without any, you know, special places like the church, St. Mark's Church, without any preparation, just getting up with the harmonium and then having to make up a song. So that completely influenced my entire poetic practice in the direction that it was supposed to go anyway from the beginning. And I thought anybody that can take that very simple piece of, simple, incisive Manjushri-like moment and teach me something with poetry must be my teacher. Because I couldn't learn anything anywhere else. I mean, not from much from other poets at this point. I mean, I felt I owed him something as a teacher, because he gave me the best thing that a teacher could ever give me, which is something that an improvement in something I was life concerned with.
This is Charles Ruas. You've been listening to a selection from my historic archives.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.